We're going to go to Luke chapter 9 today. We're continuing our study through the book of Luke right now, trying to answer this question that Jesus poses, who do you say that I am? And he's been giving us all these different pictures of who he is through miracles, through teachings, through stories. But today I'm excited. We finally get to the passage where he's going to ask this question directly to his disciples. And this is a major turning point here in Jesus' ministry, in the book of Luke, and in their own faith for the disciples. So it's a big moment here in the text today, and I'm excited to dive in today. So we're going to be in Luke 9, verses 7 through 9, and then we're going to jump down to do 18 through 22 as well. You'll see how those are connected here as we dive into it this morning, okay? So Luke 9, 7 through 9, 18 through 22. All right, so I want to start with a question this morning. Who is like the one famous person that if you met them, you would just like totally fanboy the whole moment, right? Like, who's that person that like if you got a chance to meet them, it would just blow your life up. You would love it. It would just make your day, right? Could be a celebrity or an athlete or a musician or a historical figure. Maybe they're not even alive anymore, but man, you're like, I would love to meet them, a business leader, a world leader, just somebody like that would be awesome. For me, of course, if you know me at all, mine would be his airness, Michael Jordan, my childhood hero and icon, and I've never got a chance to meet him yet. If God ever allows that, that would be amazing. But I was thinking about recently, maybe a handful of years ago, Courtney and I, we were taking our girls to a Cardinals game downtown. And we were walking through Ballpark Village, and we just happened to, like, look over, and just out of nowhere, sitting on a stool next to this tent was the legend, Ozzie Smith, just, like, chilling there, and he was, like, doing this whole thing, and so he was, like, taking pictures with fans, and you just had to get in line, it was all free, like, he was just doing his thing, and I'm, like, is this real, like, this is the Oz, like, just right here, just hanging out in the Ballpark Village. So like we line up, we get our pictures, we're all excited. Courtney and I are totally psyched about it. And our girls are like, who's this guy? Right? Like they had no concept, no idea. And we're like, no, this is awesome. You just don't get it yet. But have you ever had the experience? Have you ever been around like just a famous person or a celebrity or somebody like that? When you get in that situation, oftentimes you'll see like different reactions from people. And I think like the responses tend to fall in like three major categories, if you will. Okay, I think one response you oftentimes see around famous people is the like trying to impress them. You know this person, right? They're talking like they're all like buddy, like hey, me and you, like we're the same, and like trying to like you know have some connection to impress this person as if they're really cool, like they are, or they're somehow equal to them. And I think that's because they oftentimes feel threatened a little bit by like how you know, famous they are, and they're celebrity, and so they're like, I got to kind of like beef myself up here to make it look like I'm pretty awesome too. So that's one response that I've seen. Number two is trying to get something from them, right? They hate like, oh, I'm your biggest fan. I loved you. You're awesome. You know, we've been following you for a long time, and hey, like by the way, could we get some tickets, right? Or can we like, could you get us some merch or something? Like they're trying to use them to get something from them, right? And then the third response that I put around was the person who kind of lays back and they don't get in line. They don't really want to like get up in the crowd and talk to them. They just kind of want to sit back and watch and observe and listen and try to like, what can I get? What can I glean from this person? They're obviously famous for a reason, right? They got something special about them. Maybe there's something I can learn and kind of incorporate into who I am and imitate that in some way. Well, today when we get into this text, Jesus' celebrity is going to finally kind of come to the surface, kind of catching up to him. He's been teaching, he's been doing miracles, he's starting to kind of make a name for himself a little bit. And we're going to see these three responses play out in the text today in response to Jesus. And as we do that, I want us to wrestle with this question for ourselves, for our own hearts. How am I responding to the greatness of Jesus? How am I responding to the greatness of Jesus? We all have to come face to face with that question as we understand who he really is and what that means for our lives and our hearts. And so we're going to look at some responses. I want you to kind of assess your own heart about where do you fall in these in these responses. So let's go ahead and get into the text. Look at verse 7. It says, "Now Herod the Tetrarch heard about all that was happening, and he was perplexed, because it was said by some that John had been raised from the dead, by some that Elijah had appeared, and by others that one of the prophets of old had risen. Herod said, 'John I beheaded, but who is this about whom I hear such things?' And he sought to see him." So let's pause there. Here's the first question. Is Jesus a threat to my greatness? When I think about my response to who Jesus is Jesus, do I perceive Jesus as a threat to my own greatness? Now, the main person, obviously, in these couple of verses is Herod. Herod the Tetrarch is what he's called here. That wasn't actually his name. That was his title. His name was Herod Antipas, and he was the ruler of Galilee. He was the king, if you will, without actually having that title, of that region, right? And this is the main region in which Jesus has been doing his ministry up to this point. His miracles, his teachings, they've all been happening in Galilee. And so Herod's starting to hear about this, and I think the reason it's put right here in the middle of the disciples' mission that we studied the last 2 weeks. Remember, the 12 were sent out on mission, and they came back and gave the report. This kind of falls right in the middle of that story, because I think as they were going around telling people about Jesus from town to town, Herod's hearing more and more talk about who Jesus is, about his teachings, about his miracles, and he's starting to be like, man, who is this guy? And it says that he was perplexed. He couldn't make sense of it all. He's like, this isn't adding up for me, right? He says, because it was said by some that he was John the Baptist who has been raised from the dead. And this totally freaked Herod out, because as he admits right here, he's like, John, I beheaded. Like, I personally had this guy killed, and now they're saying he's back. That would freak you out, right? Now, Luke doesn't give us the full story here in his gospel, but in the other gospels, they give us kind of the backstory to this, that Herod actually arrested John because he was preaching against Herod and against some decisions that he had been making in his kingdom and in his family. And then eventually his wife has her husband, Herod, kill John the Baptist for her as a present. Family dynamics, right? So, but that's what's happening here. And so Luke doesn't really explain all that. He just kind of just drops this bomb here in the middle of this whole thing. But Herod, ultimately, he killed John the Baptist because he saw John as a threat to him, right? As a threat to his family and the life that he was building. Herod had taken his brother's wife, and it was this whole thing, and John's like, hey, you can't do that. So he saw him as a threat to his life, to his family. He saw him as a threat to his power and his personal authority, right? That he was the king, he was the ruler of the region, and so therefore he gets to do what he wants to do. Ultimately, he saw John as a threat to his greatness. And he's like, hey, I already dealt with this once. Or I already got rid of this guy once. So who is this now? Who is this Jesus guy? Because some people are saying it's John again. But that question, who is this, hangs over not only this text, but the entire book of Luke. This is the reason Luke wrote this, was to explain who is Jesus. And so Herod's dealing with that same issue now in his own heart and mind. But a resurrected John wasn't the only explanation that was given, right? They said it could be John. It could also be Elijah, one of the old prophets, come back to life. It could be one of the other older prophets who have come back to life. But those options really weren't any better for Herod, because if you know anything about Old Testament prophets, they were kind of known for correcting and opposing wicked, self-glorifying kings like Herod, right? So like, he would not have been their favorite person if they were around. And so he's like, I don't really like that answer either. So Jesus clearly is a threat. In some way or another, he is a threat to Herod's great life that he is trying to build. That's the way he sees him. And so he sought to see him, to see Jesus, to get to the bottom of all this and to deal with it if necessary, if it came to that, right? Because in Herod's mind, any threat to his authority, to his power, to his desires, to the life that he wanted for himself, any threat to that had to be eliminated. Because Herod was only concerned with his own personal greatness. Now, if you've been around Harvest, I know you've probably heard my testimony, my story before, but this, in some ways, this was actually a big part of it. I was born as a pastor's kid. I was a PK, as we like to affectionately call it around here, and which meant I grew up in the church, and I understood the gospel at a very young age, right? I accepted Christ at age 5. I was baptized, the whole thing. But then my parents got a divorce, and we all were away from church for years. We just walked away from the church altogether. And so eventually my parents came back to the church, but that led to some very like conflicted teenage years for me. Because I didn't really know what to do with this faith thing that I had as a kid, but then it was gone, and now it's back, and what does that mean? And I remember as a teen and as a young adult in college, fully believing in Jesus, like 100% believing in Jesus, but still seeing him as a threat to the life that I thought I wanted for myself. I fully believed he was God. I fully believed that he came down and died on the cross for my sins. I knew that if I did not have him, I was headed to hell. I knew and believed all of that. And yet I still treated Jesus like he was a safety net or like fire insurance, right? Like I needed him in my life to get me into heaven, but I really wanted to, I just wanted to keep him like at church on Sundays or on Wednesdays and kind of keep him in that spot and not in the rest of it. I didn't want him in my day-to-day life, cramping my style and hindering this great life that I was chasing after. I wanted, as a teenager, I wanted to look at things. And I wanted to listen to things, and I wanted to be able to say things and do things without his holy oversight in my life. I wanted to date and mess around with girls without his rules and his restrictions. I wanted to run after money and cars and fame and shoes, and I know shoes seem smaller, but back then it was a big deal as a teenager, right? Like, I wanted to run after all those things without him giving conviction in my life. And so to that end, I started to surround myself with other people who thought the same way that I did, right? They would go along with this. Like me and all my church friends, we kind of had this unspoken rule. Like we never said it out loud, but we all kind of knew, like, hey, leave the Jesus stuff at church, right? Like during the week at school, like we don't talk about that. We don't get into that. That's not part of what we do here. That's just over there. It was a threat to the life that I was trying to build and live. But you know what I found? After years and years of chasing that great life, is that it was all empty. It was all for naught. It was all just smoke and mirrors. Just to show that the world puts on for us. And in college, when I finally broke down and I submitted my life fully to Jesus, he started to show me a life that was built on and based in his greatness and not my own. And that made all the difference in the world. And so the question this morning is, what about you? How are you responding to Jesus in this way? Are you trying to compartmentalize Jesus in your life? Just keep him at church on Sundays? Just keep him at small group? Just keep him at youth group? Just keep him sequestered over here in this part so I can live the rest of my life the way that I want to do it? Do you see him as a threat to what else you're trying to do and build and be and live on a day-to-day basis? Are you trying to run after what you see as the great life with Jesus over here on the sideline? Like, I'll sub you in if I need you, but for right now, you just hang over there. Do you really love Jesus? Or is he just a safety net in your life? Ask yourself this question this morning. Do I treat Jesus as a threat to me having a greater life? Do I see and treat Jesus as a threat to me having a greater life? Jump down to verse 18 next. It says, now it happened that as he was praying alone, this is right after he just fed the 5,000, did that miracle we studied last week, right? Now he's alone with the disciples. It says, now it happened as he was praying alone, the disciples were with him, and he asked them, who do the crowds say that I am? And they answered, John the Baptist, but others say Elijah, and others, the one of the prophets of old has risen. And then he said to them, but who do you say that I am? And Peter answered, the Christ of God. Here's the second question about how we're responding to Jesus this morning. Is Jesus a tool for my greatness? Do I see Jesus as a tool that I can use to make my own life great? To get what I want out of this life? It's interesting here when verse 18 opens up, it says that Jesus was praying alone. Now, I've mentioned this earlier in our study of Luke, that throughout the book of Luke, anytime Jesus is praying alone, that's always the precursor to something big is coming. He's always praying alone right before some big moment happens in the book of Luke. And right here, it's this conversation he's going to have with the disciples about who he is. This is a major turning point in their faith, in his ministry, in the book of Luke, right here in these verses. And he starts by asking the disciples, who do the crowds say that I am? The other people, not you guys, but everybody else, who do they say that I am? And they pretty much gave him the same answers that Herod had been given, right? John the Baptist, prophets, Elijah, like one of those guys is what they're saying. Which would make perfect sense for the people as a whole, because in their minds, a guy like this, with this kind of power, with this kind of knowledge, with this kind of influence with God, the only other people they had in their faith tradition like that were the prophets. These were the giants of their faith, and that was the only person they had to compare Jesus to. And they really weren't wrong, right? Jesus was a prophet. He was the greatest prophet that God has ever given us, but he was also more than a prophet. And that's what he's getting to here. And so he turns it back to them, and he says, okay, great, but who do you say that I am? And interestingly, there in the original language, the you is plural. So he's actually asking all the disciples, like all of you, who do you say that I am? You've been with me for a little bit, right? You've seen me teach, you've seen the miracles, you've been with me for a little while, you know me better than anybody. So who do you say that I am? And Peter answered, of course, the self-appointed spokesman for the group, right? So Peter speaks up and he says, the Christ of God. Yes, you are a prophet, but you are more than a prophet. He says, you are the Christ, which means the Messiah. The one that they have been waiting for years and years and years to come. Now, this confession that Jesus is the Messiah is not necessarily new to the book of Luke. It's already been confessed previously. It's been confessed by Luke himself, by the angels, by the demons that Jesus casted out, by Jesus himself. But this is the first time that the disciples themselves have confessed that he is the Messiah, that he is the Christ. Again, a major turning point for their faith. But when they said that, when Peter said this on their behalf, what did that mean? In their minds, what did the Messiah mean for them? See, the Jews, they had a very specific picture, a very specific expectation of who the coming Messiah was going to be. He was going to be a conquering king that would come and rescue God's people from oppression and restore Israel's power and freedom in the world. They believed that God would usher in this perfect kingdom on earth through the Messiah. And most importantly, that he would deliver them from Roman rule. That's what they were looking for. That's what they were hoping for. without any intended illusion, Messiah was going to make Israel great again. That's what they thought. And that's exactly what the disciples were expecting. That's what they were hoping for. When they confessed it right here, this is what's going through their mind. You're finally here. You're finally going to save us. You're finally going to make things great again for us. Jesus was here, in their minds, Jesus was here to make their lives great, to boost their hopes and their desires, to help them achieve the greatness of being God's people once again. So you all know what a name drop is, right? You're familiar with that term? This past summer, we thought it would be fun to take our girls, we have three daughters, to take them to an all-inclusive resort for just a couple days. Like, they'd never experienced that before. Let's go and do that. That'd be fun as a family. And so we found this family resort where everything's included, right, except there was this one, like, adult-only restaurant, right, that, like, you had to pay extra for, and it was this other thing. We're like, hey, no big deal. We just won't do that. We're just going to hang with the family and do the family thing here. And so we go to this thing and go to this resort, and we get there, and the very first day we're walking around, and this guy comes walking up to me in a chef's coat, and he's got some tickets in his hands, and he says, hey, would you and your wife like to come to our restaurant tonight? We've got some free tickets. You guys can come and enjoy a nice dinner. I said, well, thank you so much. I appreciate it, but, you know, we're here with our daughters, and we don't really want to, you know, leave them, and so we're going to just do the family thing, and I appreciate the offer. And he said, well, how old are your kids? And I said, well, they're 10, 12, and 14. And he said, okay, no problem. He's like, just bring them with you. He said, just bring them with you. All on us. We'll cover it. Just, we'll give you tickets. Just come and enjoy this meal. And I was like, are you sure? Like, I thought it was an adults-only restaurant. And he was like, no. He's like, I'm the chef. He's like, it's okay. I'm good with it. He's like, just come. Just tell him that I said it was okay. And I was like, all right, let's do it, right? Like, so he gives me these tickets, and we go back to our room, and I'm all excited about it. And I call up to make the reservation. I'm like, hey, I need a reservation for 5. And she's like, yeah, we don't really do that here. Like, this is an adults-only thing. And I'm like, hey, I know the chef. It's okay. He said we're good. And so she's like, all right, fine. So she makes the reservation. And so I tell the girl, like, hey, we're going to go to this really fancy restaurant. It's going to be great. I thought they're going to be super stoked about it. They were not, right? Like, they were, like, in their minds, that just means they had to dress up, and they had to, like, go to this, like, one of them was psyched. One of them was always up for a fancy dress. But the other ones were like, I don't know about all this. And so we get all dressed up, and we go down to the restaurant that evening, and we show up, and we sit down at the table, and they hand us the menus. And the first red flag was there were no chicken tender baskets on the menu. Let me just say, that was not anywhere in the listing. And I start trying to read this thing, and there's, like, all these different languages and all these different foods from different countries. And I'm like, I don't even know how to read this myself. I don't know what anything this stuff means. And so Courtney and I are kind of looking at each other like, I don't know that this is going to go super great. Like, I'm not sure they're going to eat any of this. And then about that time, the chef personally, he walks out to our table, and he's like, oh, thank you guys so much for coming. And he greets us again. And I'm like, all right, we're in here. And so he's like, how about I just bring you guys, like, family style? I'll just bring you a whole bunch of dishes. You can just sample things and eat as a family. And I'm like, yes, that's exactly what I was thinking, because I have no idea what this menu says. So, yeah, just bring out whatever. And so they start to bring out all these dishes. And we had things like escargot croquettes and steak tartare and this other fish stuff with, like, caviar on it. And then there was some like salad. I've never even seen leaves like that before. I don't even know what that was. I'm not even sure that was, like, actually grown. And in that moment, I started realizing, like, this is not as great as I thought it was going to be, right? Like, for them or for me, honestly. I'm like, I don't know if I want to eat this at this point. And but we managed to kind of muscle our way through it, and mainly because we didn't tell them what any of it was until after they'd eaten it. And we ate all this stuff, and then the night was saved because they came out, and at the end of the night, like, one of the desserts, they, like, lit on fire at your table. And I was like, okay, now we're good, right? Like, everybody's happy now. We got to see the fire thing. And so, but the rest of the week, the rest of the trip at least, we stuck to the family-friendly restaurants from that point forward. Right? We knew our place. That and the gelato stand got a lot of frequency from us. So, but you see a lot of people, and this is exactly the way that they treat Jesus, the way I did the chef from the Galeries de Sens, or whatever the name of that fancy restaurant was. They want to name drop him when it's convenient to get what they want, what they're angling for, what they're desiring for themselves, right? But not really because they know him or love him or follow him or want a relationship with him. And in the end, we find out that the one thing that we're actually trying to get anyways is not actually that great. Definitely not greater than Jesus and what he's offering to us. Do you do this sometimes? Do you just kind of like name drop Jesus in prayer when it's convenient because you're needing something from him? Or in Sunday worship? Or in small group? Or in relationships with other people in hopes that somehow that will get you the favor that you want or need to get something that you're desiring from Jesus? Is Jesus just another way for you to try to get what you want out of life? Again, ask yourself this question this morning. Am I trying to use Jesus to get my version of a greater life? Am I using him like a tool, like a path, like something that I can just pick up when I want it, get what I want from it, and then lay it back down? I'll come back when I need you again, Jesus, but for right now, you just hang out over here, and I'll let you know when it's convenient for me to use you again. So this is the way the disciples respond to Jesus in this moment. But look how he responds to them. This is so telling. Right off verse 20, look at verse 21. It says, and he strictly charged and commanded them to tell this to no one, saying, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. Third and final question this morning. How am I responding to Jesus? Is Jesus my example of true greatness? Is Jesus my example of true greatness? Interestingly, it says he strictly charged them and commanded them. Tell no one, he said. Like, he's really stern about this. Like, hey, listen, don't tell anybody what you just said. So why would he do that? That seems kind of strange, right? Were they wrong? Did they mess up? Is what they said false? Certainly not. Over in Matthew's account of the same story in Matthew 16, Jesus affirms Peter for saying this. And says, not only are you right, but this is not just something that you understand for yourself, that God has personally revealed this to you. Like, this is a big deal. So why is he telling them to keep it on the DL? It's because the confession was right, but the understanding was wrong. Listen, church, this is so common in America, where we have been churched for a long time. Too often the confession is right, but the understanding is wrong. They, along with all the other Jews, had a false expectation of who the Messiah was going to be and what he was going to do. Everyone was expecting this big conquering king, and he is that, and he will be that, but the time was not yet. That's still coming in the future. And so Jesus, he takes this opportunity to explain to them, to correct their understanding, and to lay out, for the first time, really, he fully reveals what's coming for him. What's God's plan for the Messiah? Not man's plan. What's God's plan for the Messiah? And he says the Son of Man, just another term for Messiah there, will be a suffering servant. Rather than coming to end suffering for all of them, he must come and suffer many things himself. He will suffer rejection and persecution from his own people, the people that he came to love and to save and to serve. And not only will he suffer persecution, but he says that he must suffer, that this must happen according to the perfect plan and will of God. This isn't a mistake. This isn't a maybe. This isn't it could happen. He must suffer. And rather than be celebrated and honored and followed as the great Messiah, he will be rejected by the religious leaders of the day. They will treat him as a threat to their power, a threat to their authority, and will actively work to discredit him and dispose of him among the people. They will paint him as a heretic and as an opponent to the faith. Can you imagine? God himself in the flesh, an opponent to the very faith that he stands for. And rather than conquer and reign over their enemies like they were expecting, he will actually be killed by them. The same ones that they thought he was going to conquer, he's like, no, 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 they're going to kill me. I'm going to die. Although innocent of all sin and wrongdoing, Jesus will be murdered and executed on a cross. He will be crucified, the most painful and disgraceful form of execution that Rome ever came up with. That's the coming fate of the Messiah, he tells them. And as shocking as this news is to the disciples, he's telling them right now, hey, this is no accident. This is no mistake. When this happens, just know this was on purpose. This is not the plan of man or the doing of man. This is the perfect plan of God. And Jesus knew that. Before he ever came to earth, he knew exactly what he was coming to do. And he was willing to choose to sacrifice himself for us. He chose to suffer. He chose to die in order to give us life. That, my friends, that is the true greatness of the Messiah. It's in the sacrifice. This is why we hold so strongly to the gospel. Every one of us are sinners in rebellion against God, lost and headed for hell. We have no hope of saving ourselves. There's nothing we can do to make it right. We are hopeless. And God looked down from heaven and he saw us and he loved us so much. He's like, I'm going to come and help. And Jesus came down in the form of man. He was born. He lived a perfect and sinless life. And then he went to the cross and he died a sinner's death. He knew. He knew it was coming, and he still chose to go and to suffer and to die in our place for our sins. He gave himself for us as a substitute, and he went to the grave, and 3 days later, as he says right here, he already told them. He's like, hey, don't be surprised. I know this is coming. On the third day, he will be raised. Yes. Yes, he says, I must suffer, I must die, but that is not the end. His suffering, although necessary, was temporary. His death is not the end. Sin will not have the final word. You see, Jesus, he was willing to die because he already knew that death was the doorway into everlasting life. death was the path into the eternal kingdom. Death was the final blow to sin and suffering. It had to be this way. Jesus was willing to die because he knew on the third day life would come again. But to get to the greatness of resurrection life, first he had to submit himself and sacrifice his life. One of my favorite passages is Philippians 2. Paul says it this way, verse 8 and 9. And being found in human form, he humbled himself, and by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name. There's so much packed into that passage, but notice here it says he humbled himself. He chose this. He humbled himself to the point of death, and therefore, God exalted him. Suffering, sacrifice, even death was the path to his greatness. And this is the perfect example of true greatness for us. Man, how easily do our hearts slip into all these dreams and aspirations and desires and all the things that we think we need or we think that we want in order to have a great life here and now. So easily we run after the things of this world. We're drawn to it. But so often those desires are really about making much of me, making much of my life, and my family, and my stuff, and my things, and not about making much of Jesus. But Jesus right here, he flips the whole thing upside down. He completely reverses our way of thinking. Greatness does not come through success. It comes through sacrifice. You want to be great in the eyes of the Lord? It comes through sacrifice. It comes through suffering. The level of my greatness depends on my depth of humility. That's the lesson we learn from Jesus. It's about humbling myself and allowing him to do whatever he wants to do. Whatever that costs me, whatever sacrifice that requires, whatever suffering that brings. That's my only path to true greatness. Last question this morning, am I following Jesus' example to experience a truly greater life? You want a great life? You want to experience greatness? That's not a problem. God has built that into us. We just have to understand what true greatness really is. And it's Jesus. It's following him in sacrifice. How are you responding to the greatness of Jesus this morning? Am I treating it as a threat to my goals, my desires, my autonomy? Am I refusing to submit and trying to silence Jesus in my life until I need him? Am I trying to use him as just another way to get what I want out of life, to get my version of a greater life? Like, hey, Jesus, I'll just kind of sprinkle you in here as I need you, but for the most part, like, I got this. Or am I willingly submitting to Jesus? Following his example, humble sacrifice, heart of love for God, allowing him to do something in me that I can't do in myself. The only way to true greatness is to follow Jesus. Everything else comes up short. Everything else will leave you empty. I promise. You must, as Jesus said, you must lose your life to gain it. How are you responding to the greatness of Jesus?